goat, soy-cooked vegetables, and green spinach noodles on a hot pile of rice. This meal pulled me out of my funk. My spine still throbbed, but I hadn't seen such a wealth of food in almost 3 months. I dug in with my chopsticks. Raleigh said,
"Michael, how you do this?
You never use chopsticks at home?
I thought you were part Chinese."
"My mother," he said. "Me, only one quarter."
The Naham Three had no silverware. I stopped to give him a chopsticks lesson. "This is good food," I said. We ate, squatting like peasants on the deck. Mixed with the spinach noodles was a twisted, chewy mushroom, or maybe a meat, which tasted delicious compared with the slop we'd been fed on land. When Raleigh got the hang of the chopsticks, he cried out in recognition.
"Ah, I know this," he said. "We call it ponton."
"What does that mean?"
"You know speak French," he said.
"Only a little."
"Is this stomach from the tuna?"
"Oh." It was my turn to stop eating.
"It's good,"
Raleigh said. Chapter 2 After breakfast, a cherubic young Filipino cook named Tony Libres introduced himself, using good English, and we spent the next hour dispelling false impressions.
"When you came on board last night," he said, "I thought you were a boss of the pirates."
"Why?"
He was bashful. "Because you are white."
Tony had briefly entertained the idea that Somali pirates took orders from white overlords. A few Chinese crewmen plied him with other questions. They wanted to know if Raleigh and I were related. Americans, they understood, could be black or white. They also hadn't understood our names, so Tony found a glossy magazine, turned it to a color fold-out of Michael Jackson, and held it up for everyone to see.
"You are Michael," he prompted me, pointing at the picture.
"Yes," I said.
"Ah,"
said most of the crew. We faced backward on the ship, toward the tall white bridge tower which loomed out of sight. A few Somalis sat in front of it, with Kalashnikovs in their languid hands, gazing down from an upper deck. A row of lozenge windows over their heads made up the ship's forward eyes, and two panes had been spiderwebbed by gunfire. Raleigh pointed them out.
"Look like a bullet go in," he said.
The crew's astonishing story came together in fragments and shards like a mosaic throughout the rest of the morning. The Naham Three had left Mauritius in late 2011 to range off the African coast, chasing schools of tuna for several months, until the captain steered too close to Somalia in March. One night after 12, two skiffloads of pirates fired sudden, scattered shots at the bridge. Three Chinese men scrambled from their cabins to find a flare gun. Flares and bullets flew on the high port side of the vessel until the pirates clambered up using hooked ladders. The Chinese men ran out of flares and retreated. Chin Lui Te, the 63-year-old captain, had picked up a stool to defend the ship's controls, but pirates appeared at the bridge's entrance, firing wildly. Chin Lui Te took two bullets in the neck and another in the chest. The panicked Somalis ran off, but blood spurted from the captain's neck. "He didn't even sway a bit," one of the Chinese flare gunners said later. "He simply put down the stool and walked to the back of the ship." He survived long enough to reach the engine room, where he sat down and died. Arnell and the other men who slept in the cabins behind the bridge tried to lock their hollow doors, but pirates charging through the corridor shot out the knobs. Eventually, the gunmen rounded up the 28 crew and forced them to kneel in the bridge, blindfolded, hands behind their backs. For 3 days, they sat like prisoners of war. Twice a day, they went free to eat rice at the small captain's table. A pair of Chinese engineers, Li Bohai and one other man, were excused from rough treatment. They had to steer. The Somalis gave them GPS coordinates. The ship trundled steadily for almost 72 hours at 10 knots to reach Hobyo. While we listened to these details, I saw a naked crewman take a shower across the work deck. Water burbled from a large hose tied at the height of his shoulders. Right next to him, another crewman opened a steel freezer door set into the wall without regard for the naked man's comfort, and vapor from the freezer tumbled around his ankles.
"The captain is in the back," said Arnell.
"In the freezer?"
"All the way back, in the deep freeze," he said. "It has different rooms."
"I see."
"Most of this ship is a freezer."
Late in the morning, Ali Touré, the pirate boss, came to sit next to us under the conveyor belt. He resembled a happy skeleton, haggard and stoop-shouldered, with a rictus of horrible teeth. He spoke in wheezy Somali and pinched his cigarette between his thumb and index finger. Worst of all, he acted happy to see me. He patted my bare leg, the way a farmer would pat fine livestock. My back still hurt, and I didn't like being patted. I explained my injury on the skiff. Ture summoned Li Bohai, who went to fetch a bottle of ginger oil. I still felt snappish, fatalistic, and slightly unhinged. My first experience with Chinese medicine didn't cure me of suicidal thinking or the sharp anguish I felt over the loss of my notebooks, but it did ease my back pain. The whole Asian crew watched me lie on my belly to let Li Bohai pound hand-warmed oil into my spine. Captain Ture acted like a sarcastic gentleman. He wanted his new guests to feel at home. He gave us permission to use his private toilet and shower. Upstairs in the captain's cabin. We had a dim notion of the privilege he was offering, since the ordinary crew toilets consisted of two square grills which functioned as all-purpose drains in the corners of the work deck. Salt water pumping from a hose, like the one by the freezer door, would flow into a cubic space beneath each grill, where it washed everything into the ocean. That was the whole system. A tarp could be pulled across the front of the toilet area for, not much, privacy. Before he went upstairs, Ture said, "Whiskey." "What? Did I want whiskey? What a strange question." "Sure," I said, though in this case I didn't understand the morbid extent of the privilege he was offering. Ture stood up and disappeared. The crew on the Naham 3 carved out blocks of time for meals, coffee, TV, and showers. They took most of their showers around dusk, after dinner. They lined up near each corner grill to wait their turn at the hoses of salt water. For half an hour, Raleigh and I watched all 28 men strip naked and wash. They made rude jokes in Cambodian or Chinese and snapped one another with towels. One Cambodian had bowl-cut hair and Buddhist tattoos across his muscled back. Arnell pointed at him. "When I go free," he said, "I will marry his sister." The Cambodian had a strong, square ass and a brilliant smile. I laughed out loud. "Have you met his sister?" "I don't know if he has one," Arnell said in a lilting, comical voice, "but I will marry her." After showers, the men smoked cigarettes. Bluish-white deck lamps snapped on as the sun set behind Hobyo. In a rush, the crew laid out sleeping mats on the conveyor belt, on deck, on any flat surface of the ship. Meanwhile, Captain Ture came downstairs and surprised me with a bottle of Taiwanese malted whiskey.
"Whiskey, okay," he said with a wheezy flourish and returned upstairs.
I turned the brown bottle in my hand.
"This belonged to the captain," Tony said.
I wasn't about to drink a dead man's whiskey in front of his captain's crew. I wasn't about to hoard it either. At last I twisted open the cap and passed it around. The efficient Chinese used some empty plastic water bottles to divide up the precious liquid. Western whiskies are clear and sharp, but this tasted closer to thick brown beer, sweet and lightly carbonated. No one got drunk that night, but the weight of thirst behind me, the sheer mass of silent and frustrated desire, was my first lingering impression of the crew. Chapter 3. The Naham 3 belonged to the vast international fleet of rusted boats that deliver sushi to the developed world. It was an old vessel, commissioned in 1982, registered in Oman but owned by a family in Taiwan. Asian ships like the Naham 3 and the Shifu 1 were common off Somalia. They caught tons of big eye and yellowfin tuna near Africa and hauled the meat back to the Seychelles or Mauritius, flash frozen, to be transferred to large freighters for the final trip to market. The fish could wind up anywhere in the world, depending on quality, from cans in American convenience stores to elegant markets in Europe. But the Naham 3, with its legitimate registration papers, caught fresh tuna for sushi bars in Japan and Taiwan. Longlining is factory fishing, but it's not the same as trawling. A tuna trawler can shred coral reefs. A longline uses baited hooks on an industrial scale. Tony and the other men explained how the Naham 3 worked. The line itself was a kilometer-long rope spun out by the moss-green Honda motor standing next to us. It had three wheels like bare car rims. While the rope wheeled out, the men had to attach sink lines to it using stiff clamps. These lines were called snoods. They had weights as well as a number of hooks, and each hook bore a single 6-inch mackerel for bait. In the water, the baited snoods hung from the long line at 10-foot intervals, suspended on the surface by round yellow floats. The ship, in effect, laid a kilometer-long curtain of bait in the water. Then it moved off some distance to do it again. At the end of the day, it made another round to collect each curtain, and then the men's work started in earnest. The rope wheeling back through the Honda motor would drag the snoods over the gunwale, heavy with fish. It was somebody's job to cut each tuna free and slide it down a fiberglass tray to let other men carve out the hook, gills, and guts. "See that bench?" Tony said, pointing at a fiberglass bench against the wall where a half dozen hostages sat. "That is a tuna tray." Every day they fished, the men had to assemble sections of this tray system, and each massive tuna would slide from the conveyor belt into the fiberglass maze, losing its gills and its insides, acquiring a loop of rope through the tail, until someone dangled it from the hooked fish scale to record its weight. Then it went into the freezer. Each tuna weighed between 50 and 80 kilograms, and the ship, at the time of capture, was carrying around 100 metric tons of fish. It was half full. The economics of tuna were brutal, and some business owners could be little more than slave drivers. The Nahum III had valid labor contracts, but some crewmen still felt hoodwinked by their terms of employment. A Singaporean staffing agency called Step Up Marine Enterprises had recruited the Filipinos.
"When I signed up, I didn't know I would have to fish near Africa," Tony said. He thought it would be a boat in the South China Sea.
His recruiter had offered a good wage and an impressive plane ticket to Singapore to finalize the contract. The step-up office, though, turned out to be a cramped room in a flashing Chinatown mall known as the People's Park Center. The agents there said Tony would have to fly to Mauritius, an island off Africa that he had never heard of, to board a long-distance industrial vessel and fish the Indian Ocean, if he wanted the job.
"What if you said no?" I asked.
"Then I could go home," his eyes rounded, "but pay my own ticket."
The hourly wage disappointed him. Some days there was nothing to do, of course, and while they sailed from one fishing spot to another, the crew found time to read, watch TV, or weave thick white hammocks. Two swinging hammocks near the tuna bench were Arnell's handiwork. But when they had to fish, which was often, they worked 20 hours a day. They ate 15-minute meals. Tony shook his head at the deceit. 4 hours of sleep a night. The step-up people hadn't mentioned that.
"We make $250 a month," said Arnell, still using the present tense because, even as hostages, the men expected to be paid through the end of their contracts.
He added, in a sweet, ironic, dolorous tone,
"Small money."
Step Up Marine Enterprise later changed its name on the shop at the mall, and its owner, Victor Lim, was charged with trafficking Filipino sailors in another case. Other Nahum III crewmen would tell similar recruitment stories. And now, they were hostages in Somalia, where pirates were happy to treat them like thieves. A number of pirate bosses had boarded the Nahum III when it anchored in Hobyo, and they beat the Chinese crew with broom handles. They interrogated the Filipinos, who spoke English.
"One man aimed a rifle at me from behind," said Ferdinand. "Another asked how long we had been in the Somali area. He said, 'Since December, right?' I said, 'No, it was only a few days.' But they didn't like this answer. So the interrogator ordered his gunman to blow off Ferdinand's head. 'I make my prayer to God,' Ferdinand told me, and the man pulled his trigger."
There was an explosion and a flash, but the rifle was loaded with blanks. Asian and European ships have exploited Somalia's rich fisheries for decades. They've exploited the ill-defended waters of almost every African nation, up and down both coasts of the continent, and this foreign heist of live fish represents a disgusting crime against people who can hardly feed themselves. The crime is exacerbated by trawlers, which rake heavy nets behind them and essentially bulldoze the bottom of the sea. Illegal industrial fishing can make refugees of traditional fishermen in places like Madagascar, Kenya, Sao Tome, and Senegal, where seafood matters to the culture. Seafood plays a less important role in Somalia, where the culture is nomadic more than seafaring, but the crime is real, even if pirates tried to extend their sense of grievance. Most pirates I met, for example, seemed vaguely aware of a 200-mile exclusive economic zone. International law tends to draw two borders off the coast of any nation, 12 nautical miles from shore, and 200. The 12-mile limit represents territorial waters, and foreign fishing within that margin is a crime, outright theft of food. The UN also recognizes a 200-mile exclusive economic zone for most countries, where it would break treaties for foreign interests to fish or, say, drill for oil. The legal hitch for Somalia was that no government in Mogadishu had ever claimed the 200-mile zone under the 1982 United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. Somalia doesn't have an EEZ because it's never claimed an EEZ, a UN expert told me in early 2012. Some foreign vessels, therefore, came in to exploit this stretch of water, and some pirates claimed to defend it. The Hobyo pirates, in any case, had captured the Naham III hundreds of miles off Somalia. The nearest landmass was the Seychelles' Bird Island, more than 700 miles from Hobyo. The Taiwanese owners and captain had made the dicey but not illegal decision to fish near pirate-infested waters. They may have overfished. The owners were later fined in South Africa for landing too much tuna with a similar vessel in their fleet, but the Naham III had not been stealing Somali fish. It was innocent, as far as any industrial vessel could be innocent. The crew felt these tensions keenly. Later in the afternoon, three pirates came down to the work deck, and Abdinur, the machine gunner, wanted to try some recreational fishing. The crew fell silent. Someone baited the line. We watched him hurl it out. Abdinur wore a gold-colored watch high on his wrist. He could be flashy and arrogant, but he had no patience, no feeling for a meaningful tug. Soon, in a panic, he tried to reel in the line. His thin arms flailed. The gold watch glinted in the sun. All the hostages laughed. Why are you laughing? I asked Tony.
Pirates can't fish, he said.
Chapter 4 Later, from our mattresses under the conveyor belt, Raleigh and I watched a Vietnamese man toss out the same fishing line and pull up a fat, fire-red snapper. He wore a round straw hat in the mounting sun. We saw him clobber the fish with a knife. Raleigh frowned.
You must not kill a fish like this, he said.
How do you kill them?
You must cut their necks, he said, and drew a finger across his own. It's better.
I shuddered. Raleigh went on watching with professional interest.
We anchored over a reef, he said.
A pirate upstairs pointed at a crewman and yelled,
Fish! Somali!
A direct order meaning prepare fish for Somalis. Three hostages cleared tools from the top of a dark box built into the deck, which resembled a workbench. They lifted off the metal top. Vapor rose from below. With gloves and a hand hook, they wrestled out a massive tuna and thumped it onto the rubber deck mat. It was iron-colored with snowy eyes, 4 or 5 feet long, and plump as a sow. D-shaped holes were carved where its gills had been. Someone produced a circular saw, and two men leaned on the fish to steady it with gloved hands, while the other started a lateral cut through the side. The blade whined and tossed an arc of pink dust. The strips of meat and silver skin went clattering like metal bars into a pan filled with seawater. The tuna carcass went back into the freezer hold. When the meat had defrosted, a small team hacked the strips into smaller pieces. Tony then disappeared to cook them in the kitchen for the pirates' lunch. That's slave labor, I said from under the conveyor belt.
Yeah, I want to say this too, Raleigh nodded. Is slavery?
On our second morning aboard the Naham III, the guards upstairs grew agitated and shuffled around with brandished guns. One came down to yell,
Michael! Helicopter!
And ordered me to sit deep in the work area. I moved into the prow and sat near a sun-warmed steel wall where I made friends with two Cambodians and an Indonesian. The sound of rotor blades descended and circled us more than once. From our stowage, I watched Somalis on the bridge deck aim rifles at the sky. I never saw the helicopter, but I could imagine what it was doing. When I had sailed on the Gediz with Captain Ogiert and Yashar, I had also flown on the ship's helicopter. We'd ridden out to inspect a mysterious dhow. I sat near an open side door next to a sniper who held a high-powered rifle in his lap. We circled close to the dhow, but saw only lumps of unidentifiable cargo covered in blue tarps. The vessel had a wooden bridge, painted white and yellow and blue. The crew looked Indian or Pakistani.
They stared up from the deck while the Turkish sniper took aim through our open door.
"Why did you aim your gun?" I asked after our first pass.
"Force protection," he smiled. "This is the rule."
Pirates often hijacked dhows to use as motherships, trailing skiffs across the Gulf of Aden or hundreds of miles into the Indian Ocean. This one had no visible weapons, ladders, or fuel tanks, no skiffs or outboard motors. Force protection was a euphemism for, "We make sure we don't get popped." When the helicopter came around the Naham 3 again, the chop of its rotors vibrated the steel hull. All the fishermen hunched. Every pass in their minds carried the threat of a raid. I didn't think the helicopter would attack in broad daylight, but I didn't mind being watched, and I had no doubt that a uniformed sniper was aiming out the side, making sure our pirates could see him. The helicopter left, and Somalis quit pacing the bridge deck. The mood of the fishermen relaxed. I returned to my spot under the conveyor belt.
"How often do these helicopters come?" I asked Tony.
"We have been here 3 weeks," he said. "There have been 3 helicopters.
Chapter 5. A supply skiff buzzed out from Hobyo twice a day as a rule, and the first skiff on our second morning delivered a load of new clothes. I got a red Manchester United jersey wrapped in plastic and cardboard. A label on the package had sultry underwear models and cheap slogans in Chinese, and where exactly the Somalis had acquired this merchandise was a glaring question. One crewman, a kid named G, with full lips and a dark swoop of hair, who could have been a Chinese underwear model himself, took the package, studied it, gave an impenetrable smile, shrugged, and handed it back.
"Cargo," he quipped.
On the third morning, pirates on a bouncing skiff handed up a live goat and a tall, awkward-looking Somali who carried no weapon but wore a lethal Hawaiian print shirt. He disappeared up to the bridge. Another Somali tied the goat to the staircase. The goat watched him sharpen a rusted fish knife and bleated in the wind. Soon, 4 men wrestled it to the rubber mat and held its kicking legs while the Somali sawed open its neck. The goat protested by trying to leap off the boat, but the men held its legs and blood spread across one corner of the deck. I noticed the nervous tail wag even after the rest of its body had fallen still. They strung the hind legs from an upper railing and let the gash bleed out. Chinese and Cambodian men made expert cuts at the heel of each leg and flayed the skin. What swung from the upper rail was soon no different from the meat suspended in any Muslim butcher shop. I had seen ribbed sections of goat like that in Morocco, Gaza, and northern Iraq, but with a staring, swinging head. Someone washed away the blood with a seawater hose. Parts of the goat went straight to the kitchen. The rest went into the freezer. The Hawaiian-shirted man came down to sit on the tuna bench. He had work to do, apparently, involving his mobile phone and a notebook. He used a plastic chair for a makeshift desk. He ordered Tony to fry him a fish. After a while, he asked me a question. "How do you like the food on this ship?" It felt strange to be addressed like that, with no preliminaries from about 12 feet off. "An improvement," I said. "Yeah, it's because they got dedicated cooks on board here." That was not the only reason, but I decided not to mention the relative sophistication of Chinese versus Somali cuisine. This man's name was Abdul. He had clear, American-accented English. Ferdinand whispered to us that he was the pirate who had questioned him about the ship's whereabouts in December and ordered his mock execution. The crew seemed afraid of him. They thought he was a pirate boss. At last, Tony served up a whole deep-fried ras, and Abdul asked for ketchup.
"Okay, I want all the Vietnamese over here," he announced.
3 fishermen crawled out from the crowded work area to squat around him. Abdul explained, through Arnell, that he would call the Vietnamese embassy in Kenya.
"Then we're going to talk to your families," he said.
He dialed a number, and we listened to him give a glib spiel to an English-speaking embassy worker.
"Yeah, I'm calling about your guys who are hostages on a fishing boat here in Somalia."
"Yeah,
the Naham 3.
"What?"
"I'm calling from Somalia. I just came from talking to these guys, and I gotta say, they're really, really suffering a lot."
When the conversation ended, he dialed each Vietnamese man's home, one at a time. When the calls went through, we heard quiet discussions in Vietnamese. The negotiator then summoned the Cambodians and went through the same cycle. It lasted all morning. Arnell translated because he understood English, not because he spoke other languages on the boat. The Nahum III had no common language. Arnell spoke to the other men in an improvised pidgin of English and Chinese and several other languages. They used the Chinese Hai Tao for pirate. Saite was the worst, or no good, from Japanese, and loco loco meant crazy. Doubling any simple word could turn it into pidgin, so laundry was washy wash, a little was small small, and eating, as well as food, was chum chum. Talking was bow wow. Too much or plenty of anything was sa sa, and it could apply to water, food, or insanity among the pirates. I learned quickly that if you wanted to express how pirates flapped their mouths with little or no consequence, an idea that came up more than once, you said, Hai tao bao wao sa sa. One man called Nguyen Van Ha sat with us after his phone call and showed us notes written on a scrap of cigarette carton. He was the Vietnamese man who liked to fish in a peaked straw hat. The pirates wanted $300,000 per Vietnamese sailor, a total of $900,000 from the Hanoi government. But they had also demanded $300,000 from each family, so they were demanding the same ransom twice. Nguyen Van Ha tapped his head. Loco loco, he said. Ransom demands were different for every national group. A Chinese man cost $350,000, a Cambodian $150,000. The 28 ransoms were supposed to total about $20 million, but what each figure had in common was the impression it made on the hostage and his family at home. That's fucking crazy. Hai tao loco loco. During a pause between phone calls, the negotiator came over to chat. Like Boudin, he had deeply dishonest habits of speech, mixing his chummy American slang with a Somali talent for insult. It harmed my blood pressure to talk to him. I heard about your case, he said to me. You got arrested in January. Arrested is a funny word for what happened to me, I said. The commander just now said you got something wrong with your back. By commander, he meant Ture. I told him about the skiff accident. Well, maybe you don't know how to ride in these boats, he chided me. No one advised me to take boating lessons before I came to Somalia, I said, but your pilot was a madman. Abdul tried to act worldly and smooth, but when he smiled, he looked smug as well as depraved. His upper teeth flared in a neat fan. We will get you some antibiotics, he promised. No, hang on, I said. I don't have an infection in my gut. I have a bone and muscle problem. Antibiotics won't do any good. What do you need? Pain relief? Abdul nodded and turned to Raleigh. We've met before. He held out his hand to shake, but Raleigh, God bless him, answered. Yeah, we meet in Hobyo. You tell me you a doctor. I laughed out loud. No, I didn't, said Abdul. Yeah, Raleigh protested. When I come to Hobyo, you ask if I need medicine, because me, I'm an old man. You say you can get any kind of medicine. Oh, he gave us the fan-toothed smile. But I wouldn't have said I was a doctor. Yes, you told me that. Raleigh wasn't doing this for my sake. He didn't even look at me. He just wanted the truth to be known. He was full of outraged justice, and in these moods he was wonderful to watch. Okay, okay, said Abdul, routed, and he returned to his position on the bench. Chapter 6 Raleigh and I slept under the conveyor belt for 5 nights. We got used to the rhythm of the other 28 men unrolling their mats and arranging themselves for sleep, while sharp floodlights glared from the upper deck, swells rolled into the ship, and Somalis upstairs played music on a tinny radio. But I woke up in the middle of each night with my heart trotting. If the worst condition for an untortured hostage is uncertainty, the rocking of the ocean deepened my disorientation. I thought about jumping into the dark water and wondered if I had steered myself into a psychological trap similar to my father's, a situation with no clear way out but self-destruction. You have made a mistake. Mistakes are human. Like any human, I preferred to be proud of myself, not ashamed. Like any writer, I wanted to be right. Now, I was wrong. Worse than wrong. I'd taken a spectacular risk in coming to this dangerous place, and the evil that continued to flow from my mistake was impossible to square or defend. Late on the 5th night, around 10, Abdul came out to wake everyone up. Come on, we're going upstairs, he said. Let's go, come on! The dutiful Asian crew took their mats and lined up for the stairs. What's the matter? I said. We are under attack, said the negotiator. We got helicopters coming in. Oh, boy,
Yeah, you gotta get upstairs.
The crew was groggily obedient. No one moved very fast. We filed up the narrow bridge stairs, but the line of hostages stalled, and we had to rock with the ship about 3 stories over the dark, floodlit sea. Abdul lost his patience.
Come on, motherfuckers, get inside, he yelled.
The Asians shifted on their feet. They seemed willing to help, but they couldn't move.
Come on, motherfuckers,
Abdul hollered again, and in a frustrated rage he rounded on me as if my presence were the source of his trouble.
Make yourself small, he shouted. Cover your head with your blanket. It is you they will be looking for.
I gave him a cold stare. If helicopters were coming, I wanted to be seen, and he had no weapon, no authority beyond his frantic tantrum. I was not about to make myself small for Abdul. In the tiny captain's cabin, several of us had to lie on the floor while a pirate sat in the corridor and aimed a rifle at my head. He sat at a small table where the late captain used to eat his meals. This pirate was crazy.
Do not even open your eyes, he warned me. If you open your eyes, you will be shot.
Behind the bridge and down a set of stairs, the fluorescent-lit corridor led to a line of cabins where the others had to cram themselves. Abdul's panic accelerated during this organizational mess. He said pirates had noticed signals on the ship's radar.
Maybe they will attack, maybe they won't, he said as he passed our cabin door, his bloodshot eyes widening. Maybe we will all get killed. We don't know.
Mm-hmm.
4 of us had to lie on the floor with 2 others on the bed in a room intended for one. The thin, hollow door to the cabin had a ragged hole where the knob had been. It swung open and closed all night with the listing ship. I slept in fits and woke from a doze around 6:30. Sun streamed into the corridor from the bridge. My guard looked sleepy and resentful, but when he saw me open my eyes, instead of shooting, he said,
Okay, come on,
and a few of us filed down the steps. We milled on the work deck before breakfast, trying to understand what had happened. Arnell told me the radar had malfunctioned. When the pirates couldn't fix it, they forced us upstairs for safekeeping.
So, all fake? I asked.
I don't know.
Captain Ture came to sit with us before breakfast and said,
5 helicopters! NATO!
Abdul came down too, and I asked him for an explanation.
We saw it on the radar, and some of our guys, they got the phone number for NATO, Abdul said. So when we saw them coming, we called them up and said, we got some hostages here, and we're gonna kill them if all the commandos try to come on board.
I see.
So they turned back.
You saved our lives, I said.
Yeah,
Abdul smiled. He liked that one.
It could have been bad, man.
Captain Ture pulled up his shirt and showed me a twisted-looking scar in his side.
NATO,
he said. He's been shot by NATO, I said.
You know Black Hawk Down,
said Abdul.
Yes.
That was the UN.
Captain Ture fought in that. He got hit by a helicopter.
So he don't like to hear about helicopters.
I guess not.
He don't like Americans either.
Captain Ture started to speak in rapid Somali.
He says, why do we gotta deal with American planes all the time? These ACs, these fucking drones,
Abdul said with equal feeling.
He says, is this America or is this Somalia?
I chuckled and said dryly,
maybe if you didn't take Americans hostage,
I said dryly, you wouldn't see so many American planes. Ture spoke with more heat.
He says in Mogadishu that day, the American pilots got dragged through the streets,
Abdul interpreted.
Black Hawk Down.
I know.
Ture made hacking gestures with his hands at his shoulders and knees.
You know what the people in Mogadishu did?
Abdul interpreted.
They chopped up the Americans and made a barbecue.
Horseshit, I said.
He was there. Ture was there, man. He says the people were so mad they chopped up the soldiers and had them for dinner.
Are you going to stick to that story? I asked Ture.
Were you there?
Abdul said. I'm a writer, Abdul. You want me to write that Somalis are cannibals?
American, said Captain Ture,
and he made his hacking gestures.
Now, oh, for God's sake.
Chapter 7. After the night of the 5 helicopter raid, the pirates chose 10 of us to sleep every night on bunks in the cramped, humid cabins behind the bridge. Raleigh and I had to line up with Arnell, 6 Chinese men, and Nguyen Van Ha, the Vietnamese fisherman, at the base of the stairs every evening to file up to our beds. Nguyen's black hair held the shape of a once stylish pompadour, and the more we talked, the more I understood that the Nahum 3 crew was a cross-section of hip young Asian youth. Ha liked to play guitar. He sometimes smoked opium.
One night in my cabin, using a scrap of cigarette cardboard, he wrote out the economics of his decision to fish on a tuna boat. As a rice farmer in Vietnam, he used to earn $6 a day. His recruiter had offered him 10. He realized, too late, that $10 a day would be traded for hard, nearly unlimited hours of work. The recruiter in his case wasn't Step Up, but a Vietnam-based firm, and Ha, when pushed, was too polite to accuse them of trickery. But he divided $10 by 20 work hours on the scrap of cardboard and showed me how the hourly wage for a day of fishing, 50 cents, was smaller than the wage for farming rice. He shook his head and batted it with his flat hand as if to blame himself for the failed logic. "Loco loco," he said. Different nationalities on the Naham 3 earned different wages for the exact same work because different agencies had hired them. "The Chinese earned the most, $3.50 a month," said Tony. The Chinese recruiting firm seemed to have a relationship with the Taiwanese shipowners, which made the non-Chinese-speaking men second class, almost by definition. The pirates picked out one Cambodian, called Hen, for physical work. He was a squat, strong man with bulking shoulders, panda-faced and mischievous, maybe 25 years old. I call him Hen because that was his name, Ken Koem Hen, but the crew and the Somalis called him by a nickname that's hard to render in English. It sounded like hail, but when I asked the Filipinos how to spell it, they said it was gel, short for the Spanish name angel. The Filipinos had told him what hen meant in English and made fun of him for it. He protested, so they found a more affectionate nickname. Hen attracted abuse from the Chinese. They would sock him just for walking by. Squeezing through a cluster of the wrong men in the work area would bring down a gauntlet of punches on his shoulders, half joking, half admiring, a direct function of his strength. From a Chinese point of view, Cambodians were lower class, but Hen possessed a natural cool. He ignored the punches and took most of his saltwater showers with a burning cigarette in his mouth. Raleigh referred to the crew as children, since most of them were under 30. They referred to him as grandfather. These Asian kids were unencumbered about bisexuality, and it flustered Raleigh at first. While we sat under the conveyor belt, Tony would come over to share his mattress, sometimes embracing the old fisherman like a big teddy bear. "Grandfather," he would say.
"Tony, stop that. You know I no like."
I didn't care one way or another. My libido had flagged. Somalia was unarousing, and ignoring my emotions was one powerful strategy to navigate an average day. So, among other sad developments, I had started to feel like a depressed old man. Raleigh and I cultivated this role together, under the conveyor belt.
"We are like the Dodsaya, under a rock," he would say.
I think Raleigh would have preferred to tell all his stories to his 5-year-old granddaughter, since adults asked too many questions. He described his granddaughter often, and seemed to miss her uncomplicated trust as much as he missed his island home. He painted a picture for me of rain on ragged palms, churches with sea-softened wooden floors, sea turtles and sea cucumbers, and shoals of red snapper. He said the Seychelles in the 1940s were so poor that it was the privilege of a rich man to own a bike. Regular people walked. Almost no one owned a car. He remembered playing soccer in the road with a ball made of banana leaves.
"We tied it with a rope," he said. "Sometimes you see one piece go over here and one piece go over there."
The French had run the Seychelles before Britain took over in 1811, and the British didn't leave until 1976.
"In 1977, coup d'etat," said Raleigh.
He'd learned to write English in school, not Creole, because the British in those days had considered Creole a low street slang. So he'd never learned to spell in his own language.
"Michael, you know in my neighborhood we got a big mango tree. It's near the store where we buy our beer. When we're not fishing, Mark and I sit under this tree."
"Under a mango tree," I said. "Yeah." It sounded nice compared with this rusted ship. And I wanted a beer, come to think of it.
"If you and I ever get out of here," I said, "I want to have a beer with you under the mango tree."
He gave a sad and elderly smile.
"Okay. We do that, Michael."
Sometime later, he asked me if I knew about the ground turtle in the Seychelles, meaning giant land tortoises that live wild on the islands, even in the capital, Victoria.
"With turtle," he explained, "you got ground turtle and sea turtle."
"Okay, yes," I said.
"You know about the ground turtle?"
"No.
Michael, why you just tell me yes when you don't know about the Grand Turtle?
I just want to hear the story.
What? The Grand Turtle, you know what he do?
I have no idea. Raleigh gave a twinkling smile.
He yell, yeah?
What does he yell? I said.
When he do that.
When he does what? Raleigh lowered his voice.
When he fuck.
Oh, yeah, said Raleigh. And he gave me a vision of giant frowning tortoises crawling across the island of Mahe in the spring, females lying still while enormous males climbed on top of their shells to yell and holler and grunt.
They get happy about the rain. That's true, eh? They make a lot of noise.
Chapter 8. One morning, Tony handed us a thick, gold-bound Bible.
I don't know if it will help you to read this, but it helps some of us, he said. I was starved for a book. I'd gone 3 months with nothing to read but food labels.
Thanks, I said.
Yeah, thank you, Tony, said Raleigh.
The Filipinos had 3 or 4 Bibles. When Tony noticed us trading the large book back and forth, he handed Raleigh a small abridgment with fraying pages. Raleigh read it easily. He remembered verses in English from grammar school. He liked the Psalms in particular. I hadn't studied the Bible in years. I would reread it twice. At first, I browsed the Song of Songs for the racy bits, and this passage brought me up short. My beloved spake, and said unto me, Rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. For lo, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone, the flowers appear on the earth, the time of the singing of birds is come, and the voice of the turtle is heard in our land.
Raleigh, I said.
Eh?
Your ground turtle's in the Bible.
What do you mean?
You just told me about the ground turtle.
It's right here, in the Song of Solomon.
Raleigh squinted at the page. He didn't understand.
There's a line about the voice of the turtle in the spring.
It's just like you said about the turtles yelling.
In Seychelles?
No, in ancient Israel.
Ah.
I read the Bible urgently, critically, like a man starved for good ideas. As a young Catholic, I had never read it literally. I had thought that the value of the Gospels wasn't their promise of a literal afterlife, but the gesture toward something durable in the human soul. Something could outlast death, right?
I'd written a novel about a dead suburban teenager that investigated the ancient Jewish notions of the soul, nefesh, ruach, and neshama, underlying the language in the Bible, and it had helped me refine my own coarse childhood ideas about death and the hereafter. Of course, none of it had prepared me for that stark moment before my first phone call home, on the bluff with Ali Dulai, staring down the barrel of a gun. God, to the ancient Jews, was the sum and source of life, and going back to God was not just an idiom for death, but the goal of spiritual pursuit. I wanted to firm up these ideas in Somalia, but most references to rebirth in the New Testament were realistic and therefore strange. The Gospels promised an unpoetic resurrection of the dead, and after rereading them, I could see why fundamentalists believe in a mass resurrection, almost a zombie apocalypse, when the corpses of believers would awake to the second coming. I wanted to train my mind for actual non-existence, and my Catholic-shaped mind still preferred my own death to be useful if possible, transcendent, selfless, not driven by panic. The first thing I noticed was that parts of the Old Testament pushed a gritty ethic of survival. Ecclesiastes, for example, is the record of late and pessimistic reflections by King Solomon, wise judge, chief rabbi, fantastic womanizer, and enlightened monarch during an unparalleled era of prosperity in Israel, who placed no stock in a transcendent afterlife. For that which befalleth the sons of man befalleth beasts. Even one thing befalleth them, as the one dieth, so dieth the other. Yea, they have all one breath, so that a man hath no preeminence above a beast. For all is vanity. Ecclesiastes, chapter 3, verse 19. I thought about the goat kicking when a pirate sawed open its throat, the way its tail wagged while it bled. All go unto one place. All are of the dust, and all turn to dust again. Ecclesiastes, chapter 3, verse 20. I thought about the snapper flapping on the deck after a flat knife to the skull. For to him who is joined to all the living there is hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 4. King Solomon wasn't helping. Chapter 9. A new pirate leader named Bakaile came aboard in late April. He was large and loping, fleshy-faced, with ears like Mickey Mouse and a cruel, gangsterish smile. His teeth had metal crowns as well as a gap in front. When he noticed us reading the Bible, he mocked us by folding his hands in prayer. He straightened his posture and gathered himself to look very pious, then recommended in a mild but paternal voice my swift conversion to Islam. He uttered the name Allah with an over-scrupulous Arabic pronunciation, careful to scratch his throat. He pretended to care very much for our moral improvement, but he was cut-addled and stupid. Tony told me in private that Bakaile had boarded the ship after they first anchored near Halbio. Bakaile had personally beaten the Chinese men with a broom.
"Michael," he asked on his first day with a clever smile, "Ham?"
"What?" Abdul the translator happened to be lingering on the work deck, too, so Bakaile waved him over.
"He wants to know if you want ham," Abdul translated.
"Why would I want ham?" The pirates conferred and snickered like schoolboys.
"When you go back to Germany," Abdul translated, "you can have all the ham you want."
I nodded. "Great. Thanks." Ever since my capture, I had dreamed about steak, beer, greasy quesadillas, great bowls of fresh berries and melon, spare ribs, grilled vegetables, and pumpkin pie. I didn't miss ham, but the pirates mentioned it again a few days later. During dinner, at sunset, we ate oily strips of pork belly on our piles of rice, and the Somalis whiffed the pork fat. They gazed down from the upper deck in disgust and condescension. Soon we heard jokes about ham, and I squinted at Bakaile, who was standing on the upper deck.
"Do you mean pork?" I said. "Eating pig?"
"Ha, yes,"
Bakaile said. That was how he understood us. Hostages were eaters of pig. Bakaile means rabbit in Somali, a reference to his gapped teeth and oversized ears. I made a serious face and tried to explain something to him.
"Christian, ham, no problem," I said in a deadpan voice. "Yahud, no ham."
Jews don't eat ham.
"Muslim, no ham,"
I went on and bumped my fingers together in a way that meant equal or equivalent.
"Muslim, Yahud, same same," I concluded with a big sarcastic smile.
Arnell, sitting near us, giggled. But Kylie's face darkened. A direct hit. If a comparison to Jews insulted him, I thought, he could boil in his own hate. I passed as Christian in Somalia because I was white and not Muslim, and the whole Naham 3 crew looked Christian to the guards because we traded a handful of Bibles. Pirates were just clannish enough to consider themselves at war with most of the world, which made enemies easy to find. Another pirate, a friend of Bakaile's named Chor, liked to wear rings and a fancy watch. He had no clear status as a boss, but he imitated Bakaile by trying to humiliate hostages. One afternoon he sat on the work deck while I stood in front of a bucket of fresh water at a table beside the conveyor belt cleaning my tin mug. A group of hostages who sat behind the Honda motor glanced up and passed me. I turned around and there was Chor, flashing a sheepish smile.
"Okay, Michael," he said.
"Problem?" I asked.
"No problem."
I noticed him drop a fish knife on the freezer portal and scurry up the stairs. I went back to sit next to Raleigh.
"That man pretend to stab your back," he said.
"What?"
"Yeah, he take that knife and pretend to kill you."
Chor had mimed my murder in silence while I cleaned my cup. Charming. He turned out to be just a nuisance, but much later, he kicked the frayed paper Bible out of Raleigh's hands and found himself punished by Captain Ture. When Raleigh told Ture the story, the old pirate lost his temper, and in a show of justice, he hauled two or three guards downstairs by the ear to stand in front of us. Raleigh shook his head each time, always the wrong man. But after a day or two, he saw Chor upstairs and fingered him. Ture marched him away, but we never saw the punishment. A rumor circulated that Chor had spent all night on the filthy floor of a cabin with his wrists and ankles trussed, like a pig.
"That make you feel better?" I asked Raleigh when the story came around.
"No, Michael,"
he said in his grandfatherly voice, unwilling to take pleasure in the pirate's misery.
"Nothing make me feel better in Somalia."
Chapter 10. The Nahum 3 crew had a sack of DVDs, all pirated. A player was fixed to the green Honda motor, and a black TV set dangled from the ceiling by four strong, ribbon-like tethers. The tethers let the TV rock with the ship. Since the Chinese made up the largest block, 10 men, they set the programming. And it started in the morning with Chinese karaoke. Keening, syrupy ballads rang out like strange birdsong over the deck after breakfast, and the Chinese would sing along. The most popular DVD was a collection of Tom and Jerry cartoons. We all sat rapt and silent whenever Tom prepared fancy traps for the mouse, who scampered around outsmarting him. I hadn't seen Tom and Jerry in years. At first it reminded me of cheap and boring things from my childhood. Fluorescent lights, mouthwash, Doritos. But after one or two cartoons, I learned a deep appreciation for the MGM Studio Orchestra. Out here, in the Indian Ocean, floating near Hobyo, I noticed the qualities of an L.A. big band that could play smooth jazz or evoke the flight of bowling balls or crashing garbage cans with kettle drums and prepared pianos and kazoos. There were hot, flaring trumpets and scurrying violins. Some of the music wasn't just clean stuff for kids. I tried to imagine the musicians who daylighted in Burbank to finance nightclub careers in L.A., and I felt grateful for every one. On Saturday mornings in Northridge, Dad would sometimes pause between chores in the garage to stare at Tom and Jerry with his bifocals on, smiling. He loved those cartoons. I tried to imagine what he thought of the jazz. Maybe the garbage can mayhem reminded him of Spike Jones, who was on the radio during his childhood, or Betty Boop singing Hell's Bells. But come to think of it, he never collected jazz, and when he returned home to drink in the evenings, he would slump in one of the living room chairs with the stereo tuned to easy listening. Coastin' with you here on the coast, K-O-S-T, Los Angeles. After Mom kicked him out, Dad tried to sober up. His formal appeal to come home, after 6 months at Raleigh Hills, took place in the living room, where he used to listen to the radio, and I think he followed some formula of apology. Mom wasn't convinced. Our house had been quieter since he'd left. No arguments or fights, and she knew he wasn't free of pills. Some addicts try to manipulate people, and Mom had a delicate instinct for Dad's deceptions and tricks. She understood herself as a protector of house and child. She acted flinty and strong, and when she shook her head, I was quietly on her side. What neither of us knew, of course, was that this living room apology was a Hail Mary shot, Dad's last-minute bid for redemption. Chapter 11. Helicopters and surveillance planes paid occasional visits during our first 3 weeks on the water. And one afternoon in early May, while I sat on the tuna bench, a black, open-sided helicopter came within 200 yards of the ship and circled us. Pirates readied their rifles. They growled at me to drape the pink blanket over my head, to sit still, and when the machine passed into view, it felt like a taunt. The little machine crossed the clear air between us and Hobyo in smooth, wasp-like flight, daring the pirates to shoot. Even without my glasses, I could pick out the helmeted sniper aiming his weapon. For the first time, I considered a leap off the ship. But the Somalis were hopped up, agitated. Suppose I snapped the uneasy ceasefire? Would there be a gun battle? I wanted to end this vile situation for my family. On the other hand, hostages might die. On the other hand, I could just dart across the deck. On the other hand, I liked to plan things a little more carefully. On the other hand, the helicopter was right there. It made a single pass around the ship without waiting for me to make up my mind. I hadn't even unclenched my teeth before its rotors chopped into the distance. This brief but nerve-charging visit left me excited and depressed, and it must have rattled the pirates because Ali Dulai came aboard the next day in a blue, half-unbuttoned shirt and paced the ship with a handgun. He conferred with the guards before disappearing up to the bridge. Late in the morning, he squatted in front of us with the translator Abdul, and they presented an ultimatum to Raleigh. "These guys talked to your family," said Abdul, referring to Dulai and the other bosses on shore. "If your family can't pay the money in 3 days, you will be killed." 3 days, Ali Dulai emphasized, holding up three thick fingers. Raleigh squinted and tried to understand. It was never smart to take a pirate at face value, also not wise to disregard him. But they didn't elaborate. Dulai turned to me and said something acidic and grave.
He says the planes and helicopters gotta stop coming, Abdul translated. If there's any trouble from America, you will be shot.
I know.
Dulai's well-formed face had a pattern of pockmarks, like acne scars, and there was a violent undercurrent of strain in his eyes. He must have changed the guard's standing orders not to fire at aircraft, because later in the afternoon, an Orion cruised high over the Naham 3, and the pirates loosed a thundering volley of rounds. Hostages scattered. Abdul cackled at the uproar. The fear in the crew was involuntary. It must have been the first moment of sustained gunfire their eardrums had endured since the hijacking, and Abdul found it hilarious.
"Don't worry, you guys," he shouted, but fear had seized us all, and I stood up, too, as quietly as possible because of Dulai's threat, and hid in the work area, just in case, until the spy plane disappeared.
Chapter 12
"In 3 days, I'm going to die," Raleigh said later in the afternoon. "I say hi to God for you."
"Yep," I said. "Thanks."
"What'd you do without me?" he chided.
"I don't know." I really didn't. Raleigh couldn't ignore the threat from Dulai, but he also couldn't believe it. His mind returned to the problem in trench-like cycles, the way it returned to his daily anxieties. He fidgeted for a while.
$20 million, Michael.
I know.
They're trying to kill me.
I doubt they will, I said.
Do you know how much $20 million is in my money?
It's $20 million.
Yes, but in Seychelles rupees.
I have no idea.
Is 100, wait, 200,
he shook his head and came back to his usual refrain,
is a lot of money. You can buy house, you can buy car.
Raleigh, with $20 million, you can buy a corporation. The next day, he admired his yellow tie sandals and said,
Michael, not to worry. Soon, you have my shoes.
How come?
Because in 2 days, I'm going to die.
But the third day passed quietly. The pirates ordered us upstairs at sundown while a storm approached. The Naham 3, in the fading light, rocked in high waves like an enormous cradle, and I went to sleep in my cabin thinking Ali Dulai had been full of thuggish nonsense. Later that night, Abdinasser shook me awake.
Sahib,
he whispered.
What's going on?
Hobyo,
he said, and held a flat hand jovially up to his ear.
Telephone, telephone.
He wore his rifle and a turban. I had a feeling of dread.
No, Sahib. Telephone, he said. No problem.
I hesitated because a move to Hobyo seemed decisive. I thought we would never see the Naham 3 again. The pirates were too frightened of helicopters. The prospect of returning to Somali soil also filled me with foreboding and fear. The muscles around my spine hadn't fully recovered from the skiff accident on our first night, about 3 weeks before, so I didn't relish a boat ride, and I wondered what would happen to Raleigh. The ship rocked hard in a mild rainstorm. The fluorescent-lit cabin swung and tilted like a lantern in a farmer's hand. I packed up, and when I walked down the narrow corridor, the walls knocked my shoulders, an almost unbalanced Abdinasser with his rifle. A warm drizzle fell on the deck outside. We saw how Raleigh and a handful of pirates, including Bakayle, had already boarded the skiff, which heaved up and down beside the ship while Hen struggled with the rope. I looked down at the moiling, floodlit sea. It hurt my back just to watch it.
No, I said, not in this weather.
I started back upstairs.
Michael!
Captain Touré and a bearded translator named Abdiwali caught up with me on the upper deck.
You must go ashore, the translator said.
Why? No. I had no authority, no particular plan, just the courage of my own recalcitrance, and I had a true instinct to fear whatever waited for us on land. I headed back to my cabin. More Somalis closed ranks around me. I told Captain Touré through Abdiwali, the last time I rode in that skiff, the pilot hurt my back. That was a calm night. I shook my head. I won't go in this weather.
But you must go.
Why must I? One large pirate grabbed my shirt and pulled me toward the lower deck.
You have no choice, he said. It is an order.
I will tell the pilot to drive slowly over the waves, Touré promised.
Of course, it was a hopeless cause. The men were armed. I returned downstairs and handed my bag to one pirate. Soft rain pattered everywhere, and the skiff knocked against the hull. It lurched up and down in slow, 20-foot intervals. The trick was to ride the boat down to the bottom of the swell like an elevator.
Do not jump while the boat comes up, said one of the Somalis.
After the peak of the next swell, which carried the boat to within a yard of the cutaway rail, the men shouted and I jumped. The landing was surprisingly soft. Easier than jumping the same distance onto hard ground, and Abdunasser grabbed my jersey. I sat on the bulkhead next to Raleigh, who looked frustrated with my reluctance.